Thank you.
So our fourth speaker is Carl Close, who's Research Fellow and Academic Affairs Director here at the Independent Institute. He's also the Assistant Editor of the Independent Review and is the editor of our email weekly newsletter called The Lighthouse. Carl is, as I've mentioned, co-editor of Opposing the Crusader State. He's also co-editor of two of our other books called, one's Rethinking Green and the other one is called The Challenge of Liberty. I'm delighted to introduce Carl Close.
So it's the end of a long day and you've had maybe a couple glasses of wine and you've heard three very information-packed lectures. So I want to give you a quiz, but it's not a written quiz. It's not exactly an oral quiz, so don't shout out the answer if you know it. And we'll try to answer it over the course of my brief presentation. The question is, why are Americans perennially disappointed with their foreign policies? Why don't we get the foreign policy outcomes that we want? And I want to offer three possible answers. Is it mainly because of poor or ignorant leaders? A. Is it B, that the goals are worthy, but they're inherently difficult, and therefore there are going to be messes from time to time, so we will have disappointments? Or is it C, that Americans are just not properly engaged, and therefore they need some help, maybe from European countries or maybe they need to participate more in multinational organizations, that sort of thing. So we're going to consider each of these and then see how some of the material from Opposing the Crusader State can help answer them. Okay, the first potential answer, is it poor leadership? If so, then you might think that the main solution to our foreign policy problems is simply to replace the leader. But consider George Bush's metamorphosis. In the year 2000, when candidate Bush was running for election, candidate Bush looked around and he saw Americans' reaction to such things as Kosovo, Bosnia, Haiti, and so on. And Americans were asking, what are we doing here? What is the vital national interest that requires that we be here? And we saw that deadlines for withdrawal were not being met, for example, in Bosnia. We saw peacekeepers going to Haiti, but no real stability being created. So what happens if you pull out the troops? Do you get more instability? Well, I would imagine so. That's why the troops are still there. So could it be that Bush simply wasn't equipped to deal with the pressures that he would face after 9/11? Perhaps he didn't know the rationale very well for the more humble foreign policy that he called for. Okay, that's a possibility. Now, Hillary Clinton has called for a lot of similar policies that Bush advocates in Iraq. She wants to pull a lot of troops out, but she still wants to leave behind a quick action force to do things like prevent Iraq from becoming a safe haven for terrorists, to prevent a civil war from occurring, and so on. So it really doesn't look like it's terribly different from George Bush. So I wonder if we see, well, also let me give some other examples. We see George W. Bush enforcing a lot of policies created by Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton enforcing a lot of policies created by George H.W. Bush. And we see Richard Nixon continuing a lot of policies of Lyndon Johnson, and we see Eisenhower continuing a lot of policies of Harry Truman. So with this much continuity, can we really expect a change in leadership to produce a real significant long-term change in foreign policy? Okay, answer B. could our foreign policy failures and disappointments be caused by the fact that, well, we have worthy goals, but they're inherently difficult? So if so, you might think that we ought to stay the course, grin and bear it, assume our so-called global responsibilities, and maybe change a few things, but don't end. Men don't end. This, however, I think is also flawed because a lot of our goals conflict with each other. So they can't all be worthy goals. For example, we intervene militarily in the Middle East to keep down, well, one rationale, to keep down the price of oil, but we see the price of oil going up. We see costs of war escalating. It sure doesn't look like a good deal on any kind of cost-benefit comparison. Also, we see a lot of our interventions creating new enemies, something that's obviously counterproductive. Okay, third policy, C. Could it be that failures happen because American citizens are not properly engaged with foreign policy? Now, there are different versions of this argument. One version is that, well, Americans are not as cosmopolitan, say, as Europeans. Therefore, we need to participate more in these multinational organizations to do things like peacekeeping and humanitarian missions and so on. Another version is that Americans are too pragmatic and need to be more principled. Right? We hear Rudy Giuliani, for example, is one who's making something like that. As part of his platform. Another version is that Americans are too idealistic and therefore need to be more realistic. Well, overall, these assumptions share something in common that's not often discussed, and that's the idea that that Jim Payne alluded to, and that's the idea that democracy works good at translating citizens, voters' behavior into public policy, and therefore that citizen involvement can be effective at monitoring foreign policy, at discovering problems before they become big catastrophes. And let me just ask a rhetorical question. How many of you knew about Al-Qaeda before 9/11 or knew about this growing hostility shared by Islamists that led to things like the 1993 World Trade Center building bombing before those happened? Okay, a few of you. Now, you're folks who come to events like these, so this is probably not a representative audience. But I'd submit that American democracy is not structured well enough for very good active citizen involvement. We just don't see problems, most of us, until they appear on the front pages. Okay, so why the foreign policy failures and disappointments? Is it poor leadership? Is it that we've got worthy goals, but they're too hard to implement? Is it that there's a lack of citizen engagement? And I'd say in some ways all three are correct. But in other words, leaders are weak, leaders are ignorant, leaders do share a lot of dubious assumptions. That's why you see continuity of bad policies. We do see policies, policies that conflict, but we do know that the business of foreign policy, protecting American lives, is difficult and getting more and more difficult with the advent of non-state groups that might potentially have access to weapons of mass destruction. And third, we know that Americans, you know, are unengaged, and unengaged for a good reason, rational ignorance. So I would say that the answer is a little of all of the above. And more fundamentally, we have systemic failures. And therefore, the solutions need to be systemic. So I want to talk about some of the reforms that are suggested in opposing the Crusader State. First, there's a chapter on Robert Taft, Mr. Republican. Okay, Robert Taft, a Republican from Ohio, senator from Ohio, from 1939 to 1953. Now, he was confronting a lot of the challenges, not all, but a lot of the challenges that, we're confronting today. He saw the Truman and later the Eisenhower administrations pursuing foreign policy that he considered a little too much of a crusader state. Those included such things as giving money to foreign governments to sort of woo them in your court. It included using the military to secure access to raw materials, using the military to ensure open markets for U.S. exports. And he looked at this and he says, this is all baloney. And he gave several several very good reasons. He was very, very articulate in his defense of this earlier non-interventionist foreign policy orientation. Now, first and foremost, Taft called for U.S. policy to be fundamentally one that's protective of the liberty of American citizens. That's the number one thing, protect American citizens. And that includes protecting them from the threats of a growing government. Say, a government that gets too large, starts spending too much, wrecks the economy, and hurts Americans economically. His second foreign policy goal was for U.S. government to maintain the peace. And that meant protecting Americans only from direct threats. So Taft saw himself as an opponent of the FDR's Four Freedoms policy. FDR gave a speech in which he said that our goal now is to defend everywhere in the world freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear. And of course, that Taft saw was an open-ended commitment, totally divorced from protecting American lives from direct threats. Taft even rejected the Marshall Plan. The modern-day equivalent, well, maybe not so modern today, but the early 90s, the Soviet Union falls, and what does the U.S. do to try to keep Russia from reverting back to its Soviet ways? A huge economic bailout of the Soviet Union. Well, did we get what we paid for? There were alternatives to things like the Marshall Plan. One might argue that a more cost-effective method would be things like the CIA trying to buy elections. There was the 1948 election in Italy where the CIA threw some money around to prevent the election from going to the communists. Moscow also was funding that. But those kinds of adventures are not risk-free. You look at the recent election in the Palestinian territories when Israel surreptitiously gave money to Fatah. What happened when this was uncovered in the press? Hamas comes to power. People are outraged, and they see Hamas then as the group that's fighting for their interests. So those kinds of interventions can also backfire. Now, Taft was also very vocal about preventing, about keeping your policies from creating new enemies. He saw NATO, for example, as provocative, something we didn't need to do really to secure American lives. A modern day equivalent you might see as Bush's plan to put an anti-missile system in Poland and the Czech Republic, which now has led Putin to escalate the rhetoric and to start rattling his saber. Taft also challenged Truman's assessment of the Soviet military threat in 1948. So again, that sounds eerily similar to some recent assessments of our enemies, right? The White House's assessment of the Iraqi threat. So somehow Taft, like Nostradamus, made a lot of predictions that seem to have a lot of relevance today. Taft also was a big critic of the United Nations. He felt the United Nations would be totally ineffective in keeping the peace. That was because, for one reason, it was not based on any underlying law. Second reason, it gave the Security Council members these veto powers. So, practically it'd be a coincidence for an institution like that to effectively prevent war and civil war. However, Taft did favor U.S. involvement in international institutions, provided that they have a very limited agenda. And what he had in mind was an international council in which every country would have a voice. It would intervene militarily only when war friction between two countries. It was there to ensure the peace, and it would not interfere at all in a country's internal affairs. Now, this sounds a little naive to some of us, but it's not so different from what some people are considering today. Maybe it's less naive than what Hillary Clinton, for example, is considering. Hillary wants documents like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to be enforced by a new international organization. And I don't see how anything like this could be workable, and if it were attempted, I think would be a disaster. For example, that declaration, Article 16, has to do with promoting women's rights has to do with family and marriage and so on. And these things would directly conflict with a lot of the policies of Muslim countries. In fact, Sudan and Pakistan have said as much. That they view that declaration as being based on Judeo-Christian values, and they see it as incompatible with what they want and what, you know, even more some of the some of the radicals in their midst want, which would be the Sharia. Also, Article 19 is a sort of a First Amendment, a free speech bill, but again, Hillary would try to enforce this in every country. And then Article 22 deals with Social Security. Article 22 says, you know, every citizen has a right to Social Security. Well, what about countries like Chile, which are actively pursuing private alternatives to Social Security? So, again, it sounds like the four freedoms of FDR all over again. And I think that that if the choice were between Taft's proposal and Hillary Clinton's proposal, Taft's would make a lot more sense. And it's not just Hillary Clinton. John McCain shares a lot of these views of Hillary Clinton. Both want to use intervention in not the UN, which they view as effective, but some new group to keep the peace in Darfur. Right? The UN is ineffective. The African Union has about 3,000 troops there. They are ineffective. And in fact, even if we don't get Hillary or McCain, we're getting things like that already. Just a couple weeks ago, there was a new naval strategy announced that the U.S. Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard were now going to undertake humanitarian missions. This is the biggest change in naval strategy in 20 years, and we're moving in that direction of so-called humanitarian interventionism. Now, we do see crises like Darfur, and we want to do something about them. We wish they would go away. These disasters are always going to be going on somewhere. And we do have these desires to not have our fellow man suffer like this at the hands of a brutal government. So what can we do? Well, in the mid-90s, the UN had a very interesting idea for dealing with the civil war in Rwanda. The UN contemplated sending private security groups there. There's one called Executive Outcomes, another Sandline International. And the idea was that these trained professional mercenaries, essentially, or private contractors, could go down there and keep the peace, what are the two tribes again now? The Tutsis and Hutus. But sadly, the UN decided not to do this. Instead, they relied on poorly trained policemen from Zaire. And as a result, 800,000 people were murdered. Now, it's not to say that there would have been zero casualties had these private contractors been involved, but we know they're better trained. So here's a novel idea. How about employing private security in Darfur? All right. Certainly, I know what you're thinking. Wouldn't it be a good idea if we took contractors from Blackwater and put them into Darfur? Now, one of the problems with what happened recently in Iraq, been pointed out that Blackwater answers directly to the U.S. military. Part of their agenda is not to protect all Iraqi civilian lives, so they don't. Okay, so how about having the UN hire Blackwater to police Darfur? Or better yet, private NGOs hire Blackwater or other contractors. Now, Jeff alluded to a problem, and that is something like that would violate these neutrality acts, so we might want to prod him for a discussion on that during Q&A. Now, some other potential solutions in opposing the Crusader state. Okay, the democratic peace theory. Jim Payne talked about some problems with democratic nation building. The concept of democracy is quite fuzzy. We have one of the sections from the book is a debate on democratic peace theory. We have one of the leading proponents of the theory, R.J. Rummel from the University of Hawaii, debating Ted Carpenter from the Cato Institute, and both go at it, no holds barred. It's bloody and it's fun. It's like watching the UFC. Now, Rummel has also done the great service of tallying up the number of deaths caused by government. That is, the number of civilian deaths caused by government. And he puts the figure in the 20th century at something like 262 million. And he notes that in none of these countries were the murders caused by democratic governments. And he also argues that democratic governments never go to war with each other, and that's not a coincidence. He says that's because they are democracies. Democratic governments share power, and because power is dispersed, decentralized, you're much less likely to get government killing its citizens in any large numbers. Carpenter counters that and says, well, wait a minute. I can think of some counterexamples. Furthermore, there are a lot of close calls between democracies where they've almost broken out in open warfare. And also, I think that the real reason for the relative peace between democracies has more to do with balance of power considerations. Now, I think it's a fascinating debate, and I'm going to leave it as a homework assignment for you guys to read and decide. I won't tell you who I think wins, or even whether the debate is actually settled in the book. But already, that debate has had an impact in the real world. Jim Payne mentioned a lot of it. There are other things on the legislative front. It's not just President Bush who's trying to promote democracy abroad. The Congress has gotten into the act. Both houses have put forth something called the Advanced Democracy Act, and this would give lots of money to help promote democracies abroad. But this goes, this is so much less informed than the debate by the democratic peace theorists. It's sponsored by people like McCain, people like Tom Lantos in the House. And it's been pointed out that the way the legislation is written, they seem to think that democracy is a one-size-fits-all thing, that you just push and suddenly a country becomes democratic. It ignores the long culture of nonviolent conflict resolution that democracies have, and so on. So, I think there has been some quieting within the administration about democracy. We've seen some elections go kind of the wrong way, and they're I think putting that on the back burner for now. But those arguments are still out there, so that's one thing to be careful about. Also in the book, fascinating chapter on private property rights. An alternative to the democratic peace theory is the private property theory of mass murder, or maybe that's not the best description, property violations theory of mass murder by Stephen Carson. And he points out that where these disasters occur is where property rights are weak. The solution, therefore, is to strengthen private property rights. His view is sort of complementary to democratic peace theory, but it's not dependent on it. So one advantage, he says, is that his theory better explains cycles of mass murder within a country. Like in the Soviet Union, you have mass murder increasing with collectivization, right? With a greater invasion of private property rights. And as those invasions recede, there's less murder. So it's really a brilliant theory. I'm going to sort of cut it short so I can just talk briefly about the last chapter in the book, and that is the capitalist peace theory. Eric Weedy is a sociologist from Germany, and here he talks about something complementary to democratic peace theory, but a little different. And that's simply the idea that trade facilitates peace. So he advocates free trade, foreign direct investment, and so on as ways to help not just increase prosperity, but to keep countries from going at it with each other. And this is already going on. Probably the number one reason why, well, maybe number two reason, why China hasn't taken over Taiwan is their economic interdependence. U.S. and China have a lot of trade going on, and that certainly acts to help soften tensions. So what we might consider is really pushing free trade, globalization, as a peace strategy. So where would you want to see this? Well, in places like India and China. Get them to increase their commerce with each other, lower trade barriers. Or Turkey and Kurdistan, let's say. So we've got several great ideas that can really, really make the world more peaceful, more secure. And I think, though, that a lot of these efforts, especially the last two things I mentioned, promoting property rights and promoting free trade, really are going to take greater efforts on the part of individuals. Now, China recognizes the value of propaganda, and recently they've created these Confucius Institutes at more than 100 universities across the world. The idea is to help people better understand China, their culture, their language, also how to do business in China. Some good things, but there may be some propagandistic elements there. What we need is for freedom-loving people everywhere to, in a more organized way, tout the benefits of private property rights and free trade. I think that's ultimately the long-term cure for war, and also the best thing we can do to increase prosperity and reduce misery and so on. With that, I want to close with something very eloquent, written by William Graham Sumner. So this is in the same speech in which he lamented the Spanish conquest of the U.S. via the U.S. accepting these ideas of imperialism. In that same speech, he wrote, "Our ancestors all came here to isolate themselves from the social burdens and inherited errors of the old world. When the others are all over ears in trouble, who would not be isolated from freedom? Who would not be isolated in freedom from care? When others are crushed under the burden of militarism, who would not be isolated in peace and industry? When the others are all struggling under debt and taxes, who would not be isolated in the enjoyment of his own earnings for the benefit of his own family? When the rest are all in a quiver of anxiety, lest today's notice they may be involved in a social cataclysm, who would not be isolated out of the reach of disaster? What we are doing is that we are abandoning this blessed isolation to run after a share of the trouble." Now, non-intervention doesn't mean disengagement. It only means non-intervention by the government. And that allows for the possibility that we, the people, can go out in the world and acting through voluntary institutions of civil society, make our case for liberty, peace, and prosperity. Thank you.